Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, October 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Today we'll discuss the Supreme Court. As the U.S. Senate considers the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, the High Court on Monday began its new term. The Supreme Court enters its nine-month term evenly divided, 4 conservative, 4 liberal justices. Here to discuss the court's even split, the cases it faces, and Kavanaugh's nomination are Justin Crowe of Williams College and Steve Gottlieb, professor emeritus at Albany Law School. If you have a question about the Supreme Court, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email your brief questions to voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number 800-348-2551. The Supreme Court and your calls coming up. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we discuss the Supreme Court. As the U.S. Senate considers the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, the High Court on Monday began its new term. The Supreme Court enters its nine-month term evenly divided, 4 conservative, 4 liberal justices. Here to discuss all of this, Justin Crowe of Williams College and Steve Gottlieb, professor emeritus of Albany Law School. Justin is an associate professor of political science and chair of the Leadership Studies Program at Williams College in Western Massachusetts. Justin's research interests include the Supreme Court, as well as constitutional law and theory. Steve Gottlieb is the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Law at Albany Law School and author of Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Court, and The Breakdown of American Politics. He has served on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union and the U.S. Peace Corps in Iran. Steve, also a regular commentator here. Justin and Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The number to call with your questions is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. These are the experts you want to ask your Supreme Court questions to. 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551.
Can I disturb your sequence with a quibble?
If you wish.
I don't think it's 4-4.
Okay. Well, let's start there then.
In other words, I think it's 4-2-2. I think Breyer and Kagan are much more middle of the road than are Sotomayor and Ginsburg. There are lots of decisions where one or the other or both of them will side with the conservative four.
Well, then if we want to get even more precise, couldn't we say it's 3-1-2-2 and you'd isolate Roberts out not as a moderate but as someone who is somewhat less conservative than Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch?
I'd go along with that. Yeah.
Do I need a scorecard?
Yes.
Now, Kennedy.
Particularly if you'll put Jackie Robinson and Roy Campanella on.
Fine, if you wish. Kennedy, retired Justice Anthony Kennedy,
right,
was tapped as a conservative and ended up sort of middle of the road, would you not say?
Depends on the issue, right?
That's
right. I think Kennedy is remembered by some as a middle-of-the-road justice because of landmark rulings that he issued on gay rights specifically. He wrote each of the big gay rights opinions, and that's kind of part of his legacy. On a lot of other issues, though, in fact, on most issues on the judicial docket, Kennedy was far more likely to be with the conservatives than he was with the liberals. So he's moderate or middle-of-the-road in the sense that he didn't always follow along with his more conservative colleagues, but he's not moderate in the sense that he was somewhere between the right and the left on the court on most issues.
There was a long period where he was much more, quote, liberal on First Amendment issues, but it turned out that he was the stalking horse for positions that the conservatives, including Kennedy, started to use the First Amendment as a social controller. You know, you can go, you can do certain things, but you can't do other things.
Mm.
So they had a plan for advertising fruits on the West Coast. And Kennedy decided with the rest of the conservatives that that was a violation of the free speech rights of the growers.
Mm.
And then, of course, there's the Citizens United case, which was very radical in what it did to American politics. Kennedy was very much – didn't he write that opinion?
Yes.
That was as in one sense, as strong a First Amendment position as has been written. But in another sense, He's applying the First Amendment to a species of behavior which it has not been thought to control.
Not to mention that Kennedy was sided with the conservatives as part of the so-called Federalism Five in these cases involving the devolution of state power, a devolution of governmental power from the federal government back to the states, nullifying things like the Violence Against Women Act and other acts that the federal government had passed.
So he doesn't seem particularly liberal or even middle of the road to us, except there's that area of gay rights. And there's no question about the fact that Kennedy was crucial to that. And by the way, when he was appointed, there were people who were upset by the appointment because they already knew that out in California, he had friendly relations with gay folks.
Okay. Well, now before we take the calls, and there will be many calls, and I assume many of them will be about the Kavanaugh nomination, let's just talk about the nuts and bolts of how this 4-4 court or 3-2 or 2-1-1 or whatever you want to call it. In other words,
I'll defer to my senior colleague over here.
An 8-person court. We saw this in 2016 under different circumstances.
Yes.
We are seeing it now. First case that was they heard yesterday was Weyerhaeuser versus the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. This is at issue a frog that is endangered. It seems to me that a lot of these cases are not particularly controversial. Is that by design?
Well, whether it's by design or not is not totally clear. I mean, the court schedules things for docket well in advance, so it's not as though the court knew about the Kavanaugh controversy and decided to say, hey, let's not take any big-time hot-button cases on. Now, some of that may have been in advance of or knowing that there was going to be a vacancy on the court. The court
certainly
has stayed away.
Kennedy was leaving.
They knew Kennedy was leaving, exactly. And so the prospect of a 4-4 court might have cautioned them against taking some hot-button social issues. Mm. There are some important cases on the docket. They're not cases that fall into the categories that most of the American public follows: abortion, gay marriage, affirmative action, things of those
nature.
There
is capital punishment.
Absolutely.
And double jeopardy, and that's Madison versus Alabama, and I think they're hearing that, at least the initial stages of that, today.
Mm-hmm.
So that involves an Alabama death row inmate. He was tried, I believe, on federal charges. Now the state wants to, again, bring a capital case against him federally.
Aren't they already at the point of having, being ready to execute him?
Correct. That is correct. He's set for lethal injection in January. The appeal says, hey, this is double jeopardy. And I guess this would have some ramifications down the road for anybody potentially pardoned by President Trump.
Well, the theory is if Trump pardoned them for a federal offense before he's convicted of a state offense, then that pardon would prevent the prosecution in the state court. He would already now. That's a lot less simple than it sounds, or it may be news to some people even to know that it's there. But the other part of it is what particular charges would be subject to the double jeopardy limit, because state prosecutions might be based on statutes that have somewhat different elements, and then so the court would have to decide what is included in the federal pardon. Mm. It's not just a federal-state issue. It's the particular prosecutions.
So I just want to – I think we're conflating two. There are two Alabama cases. There's Madison, which is the death row case.
Right.
And that's about whether he has a rational understanding of why he's being executed.
Right.
And this goes into a line of cases that the court has dealt with over the years with what are the certain categories of people that cannot be executed. People with cognitive impairment, what's the level? How do we determine that? And then the double jeopardy case also involving Alabama is Gamble. And I think that was not a death row case, but is a question of double jeopardy. And it was a firearms charge in both the federal and the state court. So two Alabama cases, both significant. One, a kind of classic death penalty case. One, raising these new issues of double jeopardy that, as Steve talked about, has potential ramifications for thinking about Trump and some of Trump's associates who might be prosecuted by state courts, even if Trump issues a pardon.
We're joined today by Justin Crow of Williams College and Steve Gottlieb. We'll get to your calls momentarily. Hang in there. 800-348-2551 is the number here on Vox Pop. Madison versus Alabama. Now, if in fact it is an even split on the court, 4-4 here with 8 people on the court, then it goes back to the state and he gets put to death. Is that correct?
Right. So what happens in a 4-4 split is that the lower court ruling stands. Right. Whatever the lower court ruling in that instance was, then that one stands.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. We'll take a call or two before the first break. DJ in Kerhonkson. DJ, you're on.
Yeah, it's TJ. Listen, God, you touched on so many interesting cases and points. What I want to bring up, though, is when we're talking about a lifetime appointment to a federal bench, whether it's the appeals court or other or the Supreme Court, what the Kavanaugh debacle is showing us now is that a lifetime appointment should really, the Senate needs to have a new rule that you have to garner no less than 66 votes or 2/3 votes on the Senate floor. This simple majority vote allows really extremist partisans to be placed on the court. And even the Federalist Society, which is funded by the Koch brothers and the Heritage Foundation, would have to somewhat moderate the choice they allow the president, the list they allow the president to choose from. So that's what I really wanted to post. One other quick thing is this. These conservatives all claim to be originalists. Now, I have a background in philosophy and teaching ethics.
Listen
myself.
To my commentary of 10 of 4.
Okay.
That's
today.
What it's about today.
Okay, so Steve Gottlieb has you covered there. Hey, DJ, we have to take a break, but thank you very much. Our number is 800-348-2551. Steve Gottlieb is here, you know, prior to his commentary at 3:52. Justin Crow, Williams College, also here. You're here, and we'll get to more of your calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Our number is 800-348-2551. Steve Gottlieb of Albany Law and Justin Crow of Williams College here to answer your questions about the Supreme Court and the Kavanaugh nomination. And before we get to the next call, gentlemen, our previous caller, TJ, wanted to know about the possibility of maybe 66 votes for a lifetime appointment.
Sounds good to me, but there's another issue, and that is the issue of what the majority party thinks its obligation is. I think Rehnquist was as extreme a justice as we've had, and actually he would be right along with the extreme conservatives now. And yet the Democrats let him through, and they were in control. They didn't need more than a simple majority to stop him. So there are a couple of issues, but I think it makes a lot more sense. And we've also abrogated the filibuster rule, which is why it's possible to do with a – I say we.
You mean Harry Reid and you?
Yeah. Well, I didn't write him.
Okay.
But that's what sets this up.
Though I think we're in a, you know, you mentioned Rehnquist and all the votes Rehnquist gets when he's originally nominated and somewhat fewer when he's elevated to Chief Justice when there's
right.
a little more controversy,
right.
no controversy over Antonin Scalia right. at the same time. I mean, we're in a much different era now than we were even in 1986, 87. And I think the kind of positive view of what happens if you move to 66 votes is that it forces the president and the, assuming the president and the Senate are controlled by the same party, the majority party to nominate someone more moderate who would secure a number of votes from the minority party. The evil scenario or the problematic scenario is it leads us to just perpetual gridlock. And there's a tension here between wanting justices who are acceptable to a broad range of American society and wanting to give a majority party, wanting to give democracy, small d democracy, its say. So this has gone both ways. Obviously, Democrats killed the filibuster for everything but Supreme Court nominations. Then Republicans gave it back to them and killed the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations to get Gorsuch through. Enhancing the number of votes required would theoretically move us toward more moderate and acceptable justices. It might just as well cripple the nomination process even further.
I've also heard it said in connection with the appointment of judges on the state court, the Court of Appeals, that a similar obligation of trying to find the people acceptable across the board, basically kills out the best of both sides.
Yeah, it kind of neuters you and forces you to pick mundane, uninteresting people in the middle. There are a variety of state proposals on this. Washington, state of Washington, for years has had a bipartisan commission that has nominated people, including for the federal judiciary, with Republicans and Democrats. That works when politics aren't sufficiently polarized. As politics polarize more and more, and Republicans are more conservative and Democrats are more liberal and further apart from one another, that sort of meet in the middle, find someone acceptable to both sides, becomes more and more difficult.
All right, before we get to Mike and New Windsor, my question for you
Poor Mike.
Well, Michael be next. The nine justices on the court. Now, FDR famously or infamously tried to add more. And didn't go over all that well.
Oh, it went over very well, but not for the reasons that, not the simplistic, did he get those extra appointments.
All right.
It was a battle in the war situation.
Hang on, Counselor. Let me finish question here. What is the mechanism? In other words, let's say in 2 years, a very liberal president takes over, and he says, well, we've got this conservative majority now. I want to add a couple of more. What is the mechanism for doing that?
It is purely statutory. The number of Supreme Court justices is not set in the Constitution, and the number of justices over the court's history has ranged from 5 on the low side to actually 10 on the high side. So it is purely a matter of law that the House and the Senate would have to pass and the president would have to sign.
I think it was 10 under Lincoln, but
It was 10 right after the Civil War. There was an attempt. They reduced it for – it was actually Grant. They reduced it for Johnson. And then increased it for Grant, I believe.
What's the minimum?
There is no minimum.
So it could be one?
It could be one. The Constitution specifies, that there is a Chief Justice of the United States. Otherwise says nothing about how many individuals need to sit on the Supreme Court.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Mike in New Windsor's really been waiting a long time. Mike, you're on.
Hey, no problem, guys. I've enjoyed listening. Listen, I just want to preface this by saying my interest in the Supreme Court is brand new. I haven't really started paying attention until the whole Merrick Garland situation and stuff. And this may be a dumb question. I'm just hoping you can help me. Is there anything in the Constitution about the lifetime terms of these guys?
Yes.
I don't know. As someone new to it, I just think maybe that's part of the problem and part of the why we have so much infighting and all this stuff. I don't know. Maybe dumb. Sorry.
No.
It's not dumb, and it's important. The Constitution says that they are appointed for good during good behavior. In other words, the Constitution makes it lifetime unless they're impeachable, basically.
Okay.
Dovetails. Now,
go ahead.
No, you first. I'm sorry.
Well, that dovetails with a question we had on email. Are there any circumstances under which a judge can be deemed unfit to sit on the bench? Illness, senility, reckless behavior, illegal activity, and then what happens?
Well, again, that's not even statutory. And there have been attempts to impeach justices. I think the first attempt was in the administration of, was it Jefferson?
It was Chase, Justice Chase.
Right.
All right, Mike, you want to follow up there?
Who committed the sin of being a Federalist.
Right, and engaging in the prosecution of Democrat-Republicans.
Hello?
You guys, I'm a little younger at this, so I'm just going to say, like, I hear a lot in my generation the rumblings of just term limits and all across the board with the Senate, and I just think maybe as... you know, the old guard starts to go. Maybe so the young guys might be thinking about a change. I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Mike. We appreciate the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551.
Term limits is a proposal that a lot of people have suggested. There's been a lot of law professors over the last decade or so who have proposed these ideas. One popular one has been 18-year terms, that justices will each serve 18 years and they will be staggered so that there will be a vacancy on the Supreme Court every 2 years that would guarantee to each president who has a 4-year term 2 appointments to the court.
What about age limits? New York has age limits.
The Supreme Court does not.
Right.
And in fact, some justices have gone on to advanced age, including beyond the point that some of their colleagues thought they were capable of serving. Age limits is something that people have talked about. It's not clear that age is the key problem on the court. John Paul Stevens served admirably to an advanced age. Ruth Bader Ginsburg seems to be
90.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is at the top of her game.
90. And then over the weekend, I wish he was on the court, there was William Kennedy, and he's 90.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Fred in Sullivan County. Fred.
Yes. Hi, Ray. Hi, gentlemen. Good to be with you. Being that there is no statute of limitations, I think this may be a solution to put this nomination to an abrupt close. It's been reported that the state of Maryland has no statute of limitations for the alleged crimes by Kavanaugh. And I think that both Christine Blasey Ford and also Deborah Ramirez have a good civil case. So I think the filing of civil charges and the arresting of Brett Kavanaugh would put an end to this nomination. What are your
civil charges do not result in an arrest. It would have to be a prosecution. And we're going to go back to Justin and I are going to go back to the same thing. There's nothing in the Constitution that defines an event as disqualifying. So there's nothing in the Constitution that says that it doesn't even say you have to be a lawyer. It doesn't say you have to be free of convictions. It doesn't say anything about the qualifications.
Should you be a lawyer? Do you have to be a lawyer?
You do not have to be.
No. In your opinion, should you be a lawyer? No, I'm not saying legally.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of arguments about what the Supreme Court should look like and whether the Supreme Court is intended to be a body of 9 unelected elites who have education from 2 or 3 institutions and a background in certain kinds of things. Arguably, a caller earlier made reference to originalism and all the justices on the right being originalist. I would exclude Chief Justice Roberts from that. He doesn't subscribe to that, he says. But if we think that a knowledge of history is particularly important, then perhaps someone with a historical background, perhaps a professional historian, could serve the role. Part of the challenge here is that there's a lot of things that the Supreme Court does that most of the public does not see and does not know about. The hot button issues that we talk about, the things that Kavanaugh gets grilled about, is not the vast majority of the things that are going on. And so we generally think about it as a task or a job that requires extensive legal training. That doesn't mean that other kinds of training couldn't stand in for that or that other kinds of training couldn't supplement that.
Two of the people that I think have some of the best analytical ability about the cases in front of that court include a mathematician who happens to have been or is still alive, Ira Glasser. And Ira was the head executive director of the ACLU for about a quarter century, and before that, the head of the New York Civil Liberties Union. I have argued law with Ira, and he's fabulous.
Okay.
And the other person I'm thinking about, you mentioned historians. We had a historian on our faculty, Paul Finkelman, who does not have a law degree, but I dare you to try to best Paul in an argument about the cases. He's incredible.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Steve Gottlieb and Justin Crowe are with us, and we go over to John in Pine Bush. John, you're on.
Thank you, gentlemen. I have a general question, and it has to do with how cases are actually presented to the Supreme Court. It's my understanding that is it the Solicitor General that chooses what cases get to be seen by the court? My question is, if that's the case, who is this an elected position? Is this an appointed position? It seems like that person has the ultimate power of the Supreme Court because they could decide whether or not the Supreme Court even gets to see a particular case.
The Solicitor General does not control the court's docket. The Solicitor General is an appointed member of the Justice Department, nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And the Solicitor General's role is to argue on behalf of the government, the federal government, in cases where the government is either a party or would like to offer a friend of the court brief. The process by which a case gets to the court is totally separate from the Solicitor General. And the justices, mostly since 1925, but especially since the 1980s, have had almost entire discretion over taking the kinds of cases and issues that they want.
I have to agree completely, except that when the Solicitor General weighs in with respect to taking a case, he or she is statistically a bit more likely to get the result that person
– That's absolutely right.
That the office wants, let me put it that way.
The court takes the solicitor judgment's view and opinion quite seriously.
There's actually an elaborate ballet in the courtroom when somebody from the Solicitor General's office is arguing. Sometimes the Solicitor General sits there and is able to indicate in this ballet I'm describing – it's just a body language and dress thing – that he or she doesn't agree with the position that the office has taken and is being argued.
Oh, I see.
There is a certain amount of weight that's accorded to the Solicitor General's views, but it's totally informal, and there's nothing that requires the court to treat that in any different way.
It seems like then, okay, so what you're saying is the justices themselves decide what true majority, what cases they see, or how is that determined?
Actually, if four of the justices say they want to hear a particular case, that case is brought before the court. And that goes back. I don't know if the statute's been amended, but the statute, I think, dates back to the
20s. 1925, the Judiciary Act of 1925.
Right. And that's the statute that gives the court control over its own docket. It's also the statute that has the result of making the Supreme Court much more contentious. In fact, there's a literature that former dean of Yale, Bob Post, has written about, a letter dispute between Chief Justice Taft and Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes about the increasing rancor on the court and disagreements and so forth was really a result of that statute.
John, you want to follow up, and then we have to let you go.
It just seems to me that seems the heart of the issue, and that process needs to be more arbitrary rather than have political influence.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You mentioned that as of 1925, four justices had to say, we want to hear this case. Is that correct?
As of 1925, the court has virtual total autonomy over its docket.
What was it like before that?
Before then, there were a set of kinds of cases that had automatic right of appeal to the Supreme Court.
There's still a few, very few.
But since 1925, and it's amended in the late 1980s.
Why did that change?
It changes in part because of Chief Justice William Howard Taft, who has left the presidency by that point and is nominated and confirmed as Chief Justice of the United States in 1921. And tries to forge for the court more judicial autonomy, tries to forge for the court greater efficiency and greater control over the sorts of things that it's doing. At this point in American history, the courts, both the Supreme Court and lower courts, were backlogged with lots of cases that Taft thought were kind of beneath them and wanted to separate out cases that could be handled and should be disposed of by lower courts and cases that should really attract the attention of the Supreme Court.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Justin Crow of Williams College and Steve Gottlieb of Albany Law School here to answer your questions about the Supreme Court. We go to Arthur in Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania. Arthur.
Yes, hi. My name is Arthur Goldberg, by the way, not the Supreme Court Justice.
All right, fair enough.
I liked him.
Arthur Goldberg was replaced by Abe Fortas, who was removed from office, removed from the Supreme Court as a result of using his position to influence senators.
But he resigned amidst some controversy.
Right, and the controversy was that Johnson was trying to use him to influence senators concerning the Vietnam War.
There were also allegations of financial impropriety surrounding Fortas.
Okay, but just in terms of the politics and the Vietnam War and the policies of the president, he working on behalf of the president, with this particular president, that's my greatest concern. And so this goes beyond the question of Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. I mean, Johnson was a Democrat. And I think as we go forward, what's the real danger for us with the situation of our president controlling the Supreme Court?
I think that's a very astute question.
Well, the president wouldn't control the Supreme Court.
Well, but his point is that if he can control the nominations and get his people through, then he has direct influence on it. And I'm sure both Justin and I can tell stories about situations where there was a sort of pass-through between from the president through a justice to the court. And that could weaken the independence of the third branch. I don't think it's ever gone that far. And of course, there's another concern in the Kavanaugh nomination, and that is that he would support presidential power to, for example, fire Mueller, and that it would not be treated as interference with an ongoing investigation, which could be a crime in itself.
But you really don't know how anyone will decide once they're on the court. You don't know exactly how they will decide a case.
That's correct, and sometimes justices surprise us a little bit. I think the reason that some people have been more concerned about Kavanaugh with regards to what Arthur's talking about and what Steve's talking about is that Kavanaugh's career through American politics has been as effectively a Republican Party operative, right? So he was the staff secretary to George W. Bush. He was a member of the Justice Department, worked for Ken Starr during the Clinton investigation. He then was nominated to the D.C. Circuit by George W. Bush.
And he was unanimously approved, right?
I don't remember that. That might well be so.
Okay.
But that Kavanaugh has a resume that looks more entrenched in party politics than justices have had of late. At earlier points in American history, there were justices that were total partisans and were appointed to the court in part because of that role. But of late, since, say, the 1960s, 70s, we have since after Fortas, presidents have moved toward adopting nominees or proposing nominees who were more on the legal side, who were judges first and had less of a clear affiliation.
Steve is making a face. I'll tell you what, let's take a break. You hold that face and you hold that thought. Our number is 800-348-2551. Justin Crowe is here. Steve Gottlieb is here. You can join the conversation by calling us or by emailing us, voxpop@wamc.org. We talk Supreme Court today. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and it's the Supreme Court today. Justin Crowe of Williams College, Steve Gottlieb of Albany Law School here to answer your questions. Where we left the program, Steve Gottlieb made a face that looked like he ate some two-week-old fish. Why the grimace, old boy?
Well, actually, Justin and I talked about it while you had your break going on. And there's nothing left to say. No.
Okay, well.
But what we can both point to people who had positions in either the executive or the legislative branch before they became judges and before they came onto the court. And I've read some things that talks about, you know, the principal factor in whether people support executive power is whether they've worked for the executive branch. Mm. So I think there's a little bit more to that, and that it's not just Kavanaugh. And as we both are aware, Kavanaugh has written about the specific powers of something like the Mueller investigation. A little bit ambiguous where he ends up.
He was also involved in an investigation not totally unlike the Mueller investigation.
Now, that was not a special counsel, correct?
That was the Starr investigation. Which was
different than the special counsel.
Well, it was governed by an independent counsel
correct.
Statute.
And so that law was struck down, as I understand
it. Expired.
It expired. Yes. Let's do a couple of quick emails and then back to the phones. This one came in from Mark. If a nominee is not voted out of committee, does it take more than a simple majority of the entire Senate for confirmation?
No. So even if it's not voted out of the Judiciary Committee, Mitch McConnell, as Senate Majority Leader, has not unlimited power, but lots of latitude to bring it up to the floor directly.
So our producer hands the emails to me. Jim Lavoulis hands the emails.
Yeah, and, I'm not sure of the Senate rules and what the rules would be governing whether he can yank something out of committee and under what circumstances. I just don't know. I haven't tried to research that.
So even if it's rejected, he has the ability to bring it to the floor.
Can I just time out here for a minute? Just a moment here, gentlemen. Sidebar. Our producer handed me this, and it is a tornado warning for Dutchess County starting at 2:41, so it's underway going until 3:11. That is a tornado warning for Dutchess County in New York until 3:11. So that's important stuff. Now you guys
Absolutely.
Can pick it up. Go ahead.
No, just that the Senate Majority Leader has lots of leeway in navigating around the Senate. And even an adverse recommendation by the Judiciary Committee does not doom the nomination. There is still the ability to bring it to the floor where it needs only a majority vote.
All right. And
or actually only 50 votes, given that Vice President Pence can break the tie in favor.
This one came in from Jill in Waterford. This morning on the roundtable, I believe it was Mike Spain who said, if confirmed, Kavanaugh's past may affect how the Supreme Court functioned. When Clarence Thomas was confirmed, despite the sexual harassment allegations against him, did it affect how the court was conducted or distract from their duties? If not, why would the allegations against Kavanaugh affect the proceedings of the court? And that is from Jill in Waterford.
One of the first cases that came up to the Supreme Court after Thomas's confirmation happened to be a pornography case. In which I can't tell you whether there's a connection in his head, but we know that Thomas was a devotee of lots of forms of pornography, and he voted against the charges. In other words, he voted in favor of the accused individual. I do not remember in detail what the charges were.
Which wouldn't be surprising for a very conservative justice, right?
Wouldn't
in other words,
be...
First Amendment being paramount?
Well, it depends. Conservative justices haven't always... I mean, pornography is often viewed as being outside the
right.
core purposes of the First Amendment.
And certainly was for most of the conservative members of the court.
Okay.
I remember sitting down with one of the editors of the National Review, it was a long time ago, and I said, well, what's the conservative position on the First Amendment? And at the time, he said there was none. But clearly it has evolved, and it's nothing to – and today it's nothing like it was in Thomas's era, where for most conservatives in that era, you say anything about pornography and it got no protection at all.
Okay. By the way –
That's
some,
still probably true.
Some detail on this tornado warning. It's for central Dutchess County until 3 p.m. 241, a severe thunderstorm capable of producing a tornado, is located near Pleasant Valley or near Poughkeepsie, moving east at 30 miles per hour. It should be right around Pleasant Valley right now, Millbrook and Stanfordville around 3 p.m. And be listening. We'll have you apprised of any further weather developments. Once again, a tornado warning, central Dutchess County until 3 p.m. And it's Vox Pop on WAMC. We have a good cracking discussion here with Steve Gottlieb and Justin Crowe. Let's go back to the phones. Carlo and Troy. Carlo.
Hi. I had a question regarding Kavanaugh's testifying under oath and whether or not if the investigation the FBI is conducting, if he's found to be lying about anything, if that'll negate his nomination, you know, like because he mentioned boofing in high school as become
Thanks,
a...
Thanks, great. All right, moving on. Let's go to Vincent in Poughkeepsie. Vincent, you're on.
Well, there is a substantive question there. I mean,
yes.
His example has really turned you off, and I understand that. But the subsequent question is about testifying falsely and whether that would be considered, first of all, criminal is not instantly clear because there are always questions of intention and memory and so forth. And then the other thing goes back to what we were talking about before, which is even if it's clear that it was an intentional falsehood, is the Senate constrained to reject him? And that's really more a political question than a legal one.
Okay.
Yeah, very little firm guidance on any
that's
of that.
Right.
Vincent and Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Yes, thank you for putting me on. Kavanaugh has already made it quite clear that he believes that they should not, we should not prosecute a sitting president for a criminal act. And so he's already made that clear. So it's clear to me why Trump has nominated him. I mean, he's already showed his colors. And we know also the previous question just before mine talked about lying. I had understood that he even lied when he was nominated to the court he's presently on, and that's also an impeachable crime. So why would we want to put a person like this on the Supreme Court? It's just laughable. It would be laughable if it wasn't so sad and dangerous. And that's my comment.
All
that
right.
I wanted to make.
Thank you, Vincent. Gentlemen, you want to comment on that?
What was the first part of the question? I've forgotten already.
He was talking about lying and whether it was an impeachable offense.
Oh, sure, but this Congress isn't going to impeach.
He's talking about Kavanaugh showing in his writings that he believes the president is above the law.
And the problem there is he didn't discuss it as a constitutional issue, at least nothing that I've seen. So he's saying, and it's cute, right? He says, I don't think we should do this to a president. Then he joins the Star investigation.
Didn't he write that after the Star?
Well, before and after.
Yeah. Afterwards, he changes his tune, right? And says,
yes.
Well, we shouldn't have done that.
That's
was wrong.
Right.
And we saw from that example how problematic
and
it was.
And, of course, after Clinton, we have Bush for 8 years. And I think the article was written in that era, not during the Obama era. So there's you can't answer the question whether his views on that are totally political.
All right. Over to John and Canaan. John, you're on.
Thank you. I don't know if you covered this earlier, but something I wondered about. The requirement to approve a justice used to be 60% of the Senate, I think, and then it was changed recently to 50. If a majority of the Senate, and this is a modification of the Senate rules, I understand. So if the majority went back and returned it to 60 on public policy grounds, were there any way to institutionalize that so that this wouldn't keep flipping back and forth? Obviously, you could, I suppose, do a constitutional amendment, but that's very cumbersome. Is there any simpler way of doing that or any way at all?
When you're talking about Senate rules, not especially. As you mentioned, a constitutional amendment would be a formal way to do it. But otherwise, what the Senate does as a matter of rule by majority, the Senate can undo by way of rules by a majority.
What he was talking about 60 votes was actually the cloture process,
which matter of Senate rules.
Whether you could even bring the thing to the floor for a vote, as opposed to the whatever rule applied for actually passing on the nomination.
But yeah, 60 was just the Senate's use of the willingness to entertain a filibuster and the need for 3/5 to break the filibuster.
And the Constitution says that each House shall be the sole determinant of its own. I'm not quoting
exactly.
Shall decide its own rules. So Congress can't even write a statute that would govern how that process goes forward.
All right, over to Peter in Brunswick. Peter, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I have a two-part question, if I may.
Sure.
Part one, I have heard some discussion of if at some point the Democrats take the presidency, the Senate, and the House, they should add two justices to the Supreme Court to counterbalance Mitch McConnell's effective stealing of the Merrick Garland seat. And I'm sort of curious on your opinions on that. And part two, could, in that future hypothetical scenario, the Democrats issue an ultimatum where they say, we will do this unless you agree to a constitutional amendment where Supreme Court justices serve one 18-year non-renewable term. So I'm curious about the court packing and the 18-year non-renewable term for the Supreme Court justices, what you think of those two things.
All right. Who wants to go first?
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm having trouble.
Well, so I'll say the court packing, yes, that's something that's certainly been talked about that Democrats have bandied about as a kind of revenge move against McConnell. There have been attempts, obviously, to pack the court in previous points in history. We referred earlier to FDR and the attempt to pack the court that doesn't work on the level of getting new justices on the court, but does work on the level of getting justices to leave the court and getting some generational replacement with people who are going to side more to their liking. I mean, at that point in American history, court packing was viewed as a kind of attack on the Constitution. I don't think it would be viewed, at least by the Democrats in America, as that same thing. The Republicans would view it as an attack on the Constitution, and likewise, if the circumstances were flipped, it's a dangerous game that begin to play. That's the problem. It becomes a kind of tit for tat, and then when Republicans take control, is the move going to be then to add three more justices to the court to make up for the two that Democrats added, to make up for Gorsuch and Kavanaugh? There becomes a kind of back and forth in the repeated play here that becomes problematic.
Every option is a dangerous game here. because a great deal is at stake that concerns certainly things that many of us think of as human rights, that many of us think of as necessary for the proper operation of a democracy. I was outraged, frankly, when Kennedy did not follow up on his private decisions and reach an operable conclusion about the definition of gerrymandering. That was an opportunity that I thought he had described that he was going to take, and when he didn't, I was just outraged.
And why did he not? What was the basis of him not doing that?
Well, he didn't write an opinion in the most recent case. That opinion was Roberts. And so I can't tell you what happened in the background. There was certainly discussion in the process of the arguments about the adequacy of the definitions, although the definitions that were being offered were very powerful political science-generated definitions. I know some of the people that were involved. I think it's the only effective way that was available at the time to have defined gerrymandering in such a way that it wouldn't continue to happen. But understand, just like when the Warren Court came down with its reapportionment decisions, you had a Congress that basically couldn't be flipped out of its attachment to certain parts of the country. And that's true now. So from my point of view, the court has sanctioned a non-democracy.
Justin. There's a lot to unpack there.
There is a lot to unpack.
And we only have
there.
A minute, and maybe we should just take another call. All right, go ahead. Lisa, go ahead.
You're me or
quickly, okay. Quickly.
I guess I would just say, I mean, to Steve's point that the court has sanctioned a non-democracy, the court is a non-democratic institution or at least a counter-majoritarian institution, and we could unpack what that means,
all right,
simply being against the majority and whether that makes it anti-democratic or not. But it's a difficult situation to think about the court's role vis-a-vis democracy merely because of its or back to the foundational questions of its structure and its appointment and its fitting in a regime that is purportedly democratic or at least small-r Republican.
Lisa, I think it should be one that strengthens democracy.
All right, 10 seconds, Lisa. I apologize. We have some legal people on, and they don't stop. So go ahead.
Yeah, we're terrible.
Okay. Well, my question is related to the double jeopardy issue, and I understand that, you know, that I believe that's put into place where individuals can
get
prosecuted on a state level and not after.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's partly what Kavanaugh could undo also.
Okay, and that's where we'll have to leave it, Lisa. Guys, you have 5 seconds to give us an answer.
He's going to have a crucial vote on exactly that question if he's confirmed.
Well, this was a lot of fun. I think it could have gone on for 3 or 4 hours. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Support comes from New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com. Interim Healthcare, helping people remain at home for 48 years, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, interimhealthcare.com. Studio KTM Salon Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color, from corrective to fashion, by stylist Kristen Marquette. StudioKTM.com. And Adirondack Aquatic Center, Malta, New York, a planned aquatic facility where children and adults with varying abilities in the region can learn, heal, play, exercise, train, and compete. AdirondackAquaticCenter.org. Thanks again to Steve Gottlieb and Justin Crow for being here. Thank you for listening and for some terrific questions. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy, and your phones were answered by our intern, whose name escapes me, and I apologize. I can't remember. Jesse King. That's it. Tomorrow, Rich Guthrie is here. Stand by for news.